Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, your weekly libertarian podcast that has been sounding the alarm on Capitol Hill for years before it was cool. I am Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangue Ward. Hi, team.
Howdy.
Happy Monday.
Hey, Matt.
You guys have no idea out there in listener land yet how great Catherine and Peter look there in our spanking new Reason DC offices. I say spanking because of the connotations of S&M. But no, it looks really great. And I look forward to us all being able to see each other in the wider world. It's very exciting. I didn't have ad-libbing this on the top of my bingo card, but
you just got so excited to see our faces. You couldn't stop yourself.
I did. Is the gray so background. Bad. It's very nice. And people love to hear about stuff they can't see.
Yeah. Can you back up a little bit, Matt? You're kind of, in a mad as hell and I can't take it anymore mode.
The answer is no. Let's go into the podcast that you tuned in to listen to. The federal government, to the surprise of many, is still open for business on this fine Monday here on the East Coast of the United States. For that, we have to thank and or blame the so-called Bakersfield Comet. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy on Saturday, he insisted that someone has to be an adult in the room. He then faced down the rebels in his own GOP caucus and brought a stopgap 45-day continuing resolution and time-delayed Nick Gillespie laugh to the House floor, where it quickly passed with Democratic help and was signed into law by President Joseph Robinette Biden II. The measure did not include $6 billion worth of aid to besieged Ukraine. For those counting at home, that's the 133rd continuing resolution enacted over the past quarter century. Heck of a job, everyone. The leader of the Shut It All Down rebels, Florida Congressman Matt Gaetz, shot back that, quote, "We are at this point because Kevin McCarthy made multiple contradictory promises about the budget top line to different groups of people," end quote. And he vowed to try and depose McCarthy from the speaker's chair beginning as soon as today. We'll see about that. GOP Congressman Don Bacon, apparently his real name, from Nebraska, countered that. And please do cover the ears.
This is such a bad simulation. You know, it's like at least whoever is running this thing put some time into
it. At least they got the camera angles well. Don Bacon, cover your ears. Fred Young and other people who have delicate sensibilities said, quote, "We're tired of fucking around with these whack jobs."
Same.
So the can now has officially been kicked to November 15th with the stopgap spending rate. I guess that's the top line, the same as it has been throughout fiscal year 2023, which is now otherwise in our rearview mirror. Suderman, the whack jobs predictably have not been getting much favorable press. Is there a way to squint at these shenanigans and say, well, at least the Matt Gaetzes of the world have been trying to pass, and actually did pass on the House side, some appropriations bills the old-fashioned way and may yet pull something off in the next 6 weeks?
Well, I don't know about the next 6 weeks, but I think the way we got here was that Kevin McCarthy simply decided not to do the thing that he promised he would do. Right. When he was running for speaker earlier this year, he faced opposition from a group of holdouts, including Matt Gaetz, probably somewhere in the range of 10 or 20 people. It was fluid at the time. Hard to know exactly how many, but a group of holdouts. And in order to win the speaker to win the speaker job, which he did after something like 17 votes, he basically made two commitments. One was to pass a budget through regular order. That's all the dozen spending bills. We're going to pass each one of them, and we're going to do it before October 1st. So that definitely didn't happen. And two was to hold spending down. And that also hasn't happened, at least not yet, because the appropriations bills haven't been passed. And so this was, in a lot of ways, a dereliction of duty. It is being portrayed as something heroic, as like, oh, look, Kevin McCarthy, finally, he's the adult, right? He's the one who is working across the aisle. Yes, he's working across the aisle. You can totally understand the politics of this. But I think there really are two sides to this story. One is on the politics. Kevin McCarthy really does have a point, and it is probably true that Republicans would have done worse in a bunch of ways by letting the government shut down. Certainly Kevin McCarthy would have done worse. On the other hand, Kevin McCarthy promised to get this stuff done by October 1st, and he just didn't. And he's also been extremely cagey with the top line spending numbers. We just don't know where they are heading at this point this year. And so I don't know how this resolves, but I do know that Kevin McCarthy is somebody who went back on his promises and didn't deliver on what he said he was going to do in order to get this job.
I think if Kevin McCarthy is the adult in the room, you're in the wrong room, Matt Welch.
Wouldn't be the first
time. Didn't see that coming, huh? That would Mike Pence sent me.
Are you sure it wasn't Chris Christie? Like the minute long.
Yeah, I don't know. Those guys are really, they're not America's Got Talent.
That's more than
watchouts. I want to just insert this because it's been eating me alive since whenever we did the
like those little worm things in Star Trek Wrath of Khan.
Stop.
Old person lines. And I can't believe that I forgot when Alan Simpson referred to Snoopy Poop Pants and the Enema Man when he was talking about, and he was like, you know, they're listening to Snoopy Poop Dog. And the Enema Man while walking on their pants backwards with their baseball caps on. And this is, we're still in that. I bring it up not
to have
just
the opportunity to say Snoopy Poop Pants a couple
line,
times
but
on
like
the pod.
We have not. Enema Man, which is great. You know, it's like, and there's a great Reason TV video of a remix of Alan Simpson saying that, but like, we're still there. He was talking on Meet the Press about, Social Security and entitlement reform with Erskine Bowles, who was just dying a little bit faster. But we're still there. Like, we haven't done any kind of budget work in a really, really long time. And it just doesn't seem like it's going to change. I think Kevin McCarthy is going to get canned over this. And I don't think that's a bad thing. I think the Bakersfield Comet sucks. And everybody knows it. He knows it most of all, and but what comes next is,
I think
just
it's very unlikely that the motion to remove Kevin McCarthy actually succeeds. I don't want to say it's impossible, but I would bet against it.
Yeah, I'm not saying it won't be that. This is the beginning of the end. Like, that, you know, the Republicans have not been able to keep a House Speaker as long as they should or want. I mean, you know, since going back to the coach Dennis Hastert, who was like the high point. And he's a convicted.
Catherine, is there a case with that?
Good luck
like
with Kevin
McCarthy. The common and accurate way of looking at this is, oh my gosh, Republican congressional dysfunction, and as Nick alludes to, they've been doing this for a while with all the speakers. Is there a more generous reading of this, which is that, well, at least they challenged their own leaders, unlike Democrats? I don't know. Was there ever a challenge to Nancy Pelosi that lasted more than like a squad softball game or something? Like, there's something healthy maybe about that dysfunction, especially when you have a bunch of people being called nihilists. And I know you're a nihilist. So doesn't that make you want to root for Matt Gaetz despite his haircut?
You know, I was with you on that question up until you said the phrase, doesn't that make you want to root for Matt Gaetz? And now I feel torn again. No, I mean, see? I suppose like a rebellion on the other side of the aisle looks like it's very high school, right? We're pulling fire alarms to get out of stuff. So I guess there's that.
His defense was something like, I thought it was a water fountain and I was thirsty.
You know what? I'm a little bit of an apologist. I do feel like he was trying to do the thing where you like get the handicap door to go or something, and he just screwed up. I actually think that's probably what happened. But no, the whack jobs are right. Like, the whack jobs are right. I'm sorry that they're giving Kevin McCarthy a headache, and they're not right about everything, but it is right that we should do a normal budget process. It is right that we should debate these things and not do it all in a rush and a continuing resolution. Those positions are correct. And yeah, it is heartening that there's at least some contingent on the Hill that wants to fight for that stuff. We've talked on this podcast about how in years past, there was usually like a couple of folks on the Hill that we'd be like, oh, those guys are doing the right thing, even if we don't agree with them on everything. We don't agree with them on everything part has gotten bigger with this crew, but I still do think they were right to try and extract concessions from leadership to do a normal budget process, and they would be right to continue to fight.
They're right on the budget process and on total spending levels, but not on immigration and the border,
yep,
which is the other big issue up for debate, you know, as part of this.
Let's use that as a segue, Peter Sudeman. Thank you very much for that. We alluded previously to the GOP debate last Wednesday in Simi Valley. Not Simi Valley, people. It's Simi Valley. I don't want to go whole Nevada, Oregon on you, but come on now. Over at the Reagan Library, I think the presidential candidates ranked between 2nd and 8th in the polls were the ones who participated in it, talking about industrial policy and social media and Vivek Ramaswamy's red Chinese holdings. One thing they all seem to agree about per Suderman was how America needs to use everything just short of, I think, a nuclear arsenal to attack fentanyl at our southern border. Former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations and current KMW heartthrob Nikki Haley proposed stopping all normal trade relations with China until they stop killing Americans with fentanyl poison. Ramaswamy suggested enacting a federal ban on social media for teenagers because non sequiturs are fun. And Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, Meatball Ron, attempted to break Senator J.D. Vance's land speed record for shortest verbal distance between the words Ukraine, fentanyl, and southern border. Catherine, we have here at Reason published, under your editorial leadership, published a bunch of post-debate debunkery on all things fentanyl-related. Are libertarians kind of well-actualing ourselves to death here? We're talking like huge numbers of ODs, huge numbers of people massing at the southern border. People are very upset about this. Isn't this all the world libertarians wanted? And if so, isn't there blood on your terribly long hands?
Yeah. The reaction that I had during the debate was that, like, it was one of these things where they just had all the keywords. And it was like this race to say them as quickly as possible. Like they were playing a secret drinking game or something.
My voice is my passport.
Yeah.
Verify me.
It was a reboot of the sneakers voice activation plot for sure. And the passcode in this case was Ukraine, Mexico, fentanyl. Yeah. So the fentanyl poisonings and overdoses situation is very real. And I think it would be a true moron to say, no, it's totally fine. There is nothing to see here at all. However, the desperate desire to make everything about everything is misguided. And, you know, having a different immigration policy and having a different policy with respect to our involvement in the war in Ukraine would be almost perfectly irrelevant, I think, to the fentanyl deaths that we are looking at and trying to figure out how to deal with. This is partially because fentanyl comes from a bunch of places. It is not only coming across the border from Mexico being held. Did we all see the video of the mother crawling under the barbed wire with her baby? Like, that lady's not bringing the fentanyl. We can just...
That baby was later tested by Matt Walsh, not Matt Well.
Yeah, 99% the baby is not pure fentanyl. And so I think, like, it's just so easy. It should be a very easy thing to disaggregate whatever is going on with that woman, where it is so urgent to her that she will literally crawl under barbed wire with a baby to come here. And the fact that, yes, a bunch of Americans are dying, often being poisoned. And this is a Jacob Sullum point, which I really think you can't make enough. Like, there are people who are ODing on fentanyl, but there are also people who are trying to take something else and being poisoned. And that is the result of a black market. And those are yet still two different things from how much should we be involved in the war in Ukraine. You do not help anything by jumbling all those words together and then, like, maybe also blaming neoliberals while you're at it.
Nick, you spend time in both the harm reduction community and also the...
And the harm production.
And the harm production community. That, in fact, called, that's yeah. about right. Or at least the street casualty.
It's a good name for a podcast, the harm production
here
community.
In New York City. How come those two tastes don't seem to be tasting great together? Why isn't harm reduction translating, why does it feel like it's not translating all that great in American cities right now?
Yeah, that's an excellent question, especially because in places like New York State, as well as Kentucky and whatnot, there are, you know, real serious attempts to implement harm reduction as the kind of governing mentality of the drug war and of helping people. And, you know, all harm reduction is about is ultimately is recognizing that prohibition generally exacerbates a lot of problems. And like what you should be doing is trying to reduce the overall amount of harm to society and to individuals, and it both people who use and people who end up, being victimized by bad laws who don't do any drugs or anything like that. I think it's because we're in a presidential season and a prolonged moral panic. Catherine is right that it was like, you know, somebody was saying, you know, China, fentanyl, Mexico, immigrants. The next person was immigrants, Mexico. They were like trying to find the right combination that would open up the ability to become the Republican nominee just by chanting these four words or whatever in separate sequences. It's a big, big problem. I think what needs to happen is that libertarians need to keep disaggregating these different issues. Fentanyl overdose or overdoses are, you know, being driven by the drug war and black markets and drugs and the inability of people to talk about substance abuse as well as the need for pain treatment and things like that. And we need to keep pushing on that because those people are going to die no matter what. And even if we stop the overall moral panic, we need to change the policies that actually help people deal with all of their, you know, pain, but also substance abuse issues and things like that. And the starting point of that is to know what you're taking. The better way to create a better market in drugs is by legalizing more things and stopping demonizing things. We all know this. And what is interesting is that the state level, at least, and sometimes with federal funding, more states are starting to move in that direction. So I think that's a good thing. I think, you know, it isn't just random that, you know, Republican nominees or would-be presidential candidates are fixating on Mexico. You know, that's scary. Immigrants, they believe that that is scary, particularly illegal ones. Drugs coming from China, you know, they are in a desperate bid to kind of, bump up to the second or first position. And so they're going to keep hitting that. But it has virtually nothing to do with
reality.
It's also
kind of weird that they're treating, like, let's do a war on a drug like a novel public policy proposal. Like, they're like, oh, hey, I have an idea. Like, but we should... like, stop this drug from coming into our country. That's an idea that we could try. And it's like, where have you been? We can't do that. We failed at that.
They believe because, you know, weed is, of course, not federally recognized, but is essentially legal in most parts of the country. And there's been this surge towards plant-based psychedelics and whatnot. People, you know, mistakenly think the drug war is over. And it's like, you know, we haven't even begun the wind down. That confusion, I mean, I think it's intentional on the part of politicians, but it is something that needs to be dispelled at every moment. And I think the same thing with the immigration issues. There are issues at the southern border. The other big issue in immigration in America is that we don't have enough immigrants. We don't have enough, and particularly high-skilled or people who are trying to come in through legal means. We're only going to have more illegals if we don't fix the immigration.
A lot of Republicans and conservatives also believe that pot legalization has been a failure and that it is something that we should try to roll back.
The best moment in the GOP debate, which we will hopefully have time to talk more about a little bit later, was an advertisement for me. It was an advertisement that tried to make Joe Biden look soft on the border, and he's actually enriching the Mexican cartels. It's like a guy with a cowboy hat in like Arizona or something. And he's doing this by making menthols illegal. And I was like, yes, we finally got a wow. Anti-prohibition moment on a GOP debate, making an important and, essentially correct point.
Do Republicans think like menthol cigarettes repel Mexicans or something? Maybe we start working those angles.
Yeah.
Just confuse everybody.
Poll tested here. Peter, you pay attention to policy and how it translates and whatnot. Can you walk us through how, given a president and a president's power, how the kind of political rhetoric that we saw and that we continue to see in the Republican debate and in the Republican political conversation as regards fentanyl, as regards sending the military to Mexico, which is pretty unanimous at this point, it seems to be, might actually translate into policy under the next GOP administration.
I think it's totally unclear how it would actually translate into any kind of practical action. You can imagine something as wackadoodle as a full-scale quasi-invasion or at least regular airstrikes on cartel facilities in Mexico without the Mexican government's permission. That is at least a theoretical possibility, though I certainly wouldn't bet on that being the most likely outcome. More likely, it's going to look like something more like what we saw under Trump, where he deployed the National Guard to the border, an expanded version of that, and then selected kind of special forces operations on the other side of the border, maybe with the Mexican government's permission, maybe not, somewhat unclear, but we would just be kind of waging a covert little war with our neighbor. Maybe some parts of the government there would be okay with it, maybe not. It just seems like it would be a very bad idea, because even if you wage a little war, even if you do it in the smart way, even if you have Nikki Haley running our little war against Mexico, there's no way it's going to go well. It's very unlikely to stay little. And part of the thing is, let's say the Mexican government buys in, or at least decides not to, you know, to see this as a attack on their sovereignty, which it arguably would be if the Mexican government is like, no, actually, you can't bomb inside our borders, and we just did it anyway. Let's say the Mexican government just decided, okay, we're going to let this play out, and we are not going to take military action in response. You would still have heavily armed, well-funded cartels that have a proven ability to move things like, say, guns and operatives across the southern border, and they could take revenge, right? Like they could start waging a little war inside the United States against American personnel, whether that's military or political or just civilians. And so I think that there would be real risks to Americans to doing not just it's not just budgetary. It's not just that this is a bad idea from a diplomacy perspective. I think that doing this would put American lives at risk in ways that Republican candidates proposing to bomb the southern border or whatever are totally not acknowledging.
I fell for the tiny little smart war waged by Nikki Haley for strategic purposes once, and I'm not going to fall for it again.
What was the first tiny little war that she
It was technically not waged by Nikki Haley, but that was the promise of the first Iraq war, the second Iraq war. it was going to be so high-tech and clever and surgical, and we were going to get it done with no lost lives, and like it wasn't Nikki Haley, but spiritually same vibes.
There is a great movement that is mostly being pushed by hyper-conservative and libertarians called Defend the Guard, which is parallel to all of this. It is a state-based move where they're trying to get state legislatures to make it illegal to pass a federal law saying you can't deploy National Guardsmen and women into active combat duty unless there is an actual war declared.
Hey, that's a good idea.
It is really kind of fascinating because it's mostly on the right side of the spectrum now, although, you know, all of these things kind of get together at some point. It's, you know, there are a lot of tensions there. That are going to explode in, I think, you know, a beautiful kind of fireworks display sometime over the next couple of years. We can see, you know, elements on the left as well. But I think the Defend the Guard movement is kind of a fascinating counterpoint, because on a lot of levels, the same people are like, oh, you know, we're worried about Mexicans, we're worried about fentanyl, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, this is where kind of focusing on constitutional constraints on power may actually yield some interesting and effective political coalitions.
It's just absolutely crazy to me that the new right, the post-Trump right, has organized itself in so many ways around opposition to George W. Bush's failed wars. And the idea that American interventionism just went way too far, that the neocons, you know, were just way too war happy, way too interested in bombing everywhere else in the world. And then also that same new right, the most consensus position that they have is, but we should also bomb Mexico to stop the fentanyl.
Let's just keep zipping on through. Topic here. Why not? That's what happens when you don't have advertisements in your podcast. So, yeah, we talked about the GOP debate last week. Let's each grab a participant in a consensual-ish way to talk about his or her performance or lack thereof. Catherine, why don't you start us off?
Yeah, I'll go back to my gal Nikki Haley, since that's what we're talking about this whole podcast a little bit. I did not feel like she was on her game in the same way, either from just a straight up debate performance perspective or from a saying libertarian stuff perspective. But I did think that the debate offered a very interesting case study in the ways that libertarian ideas function in electoral politics, and especially in the GOP, because she had one good line in the previous debate. And it was about how the Democrats and Trump have spent too much and they share responsibility, and that the people on this stage are going to not be that and they're going to fix that problem. And we saw in the first few minutes of this debate, of the second debate, both Chris Christie and Ron DeSantis straight up steal that line. Like, they both did versions of that line, and they delivered competently in both cases. And like, I think that's how libertarians win-ish in real electoral politics. Like, you just figure out how to say the thing in a way that resonates, and then you hope that the people who might actually hold power hear it, like the people liked it, say it too, and then maybe do it when they get into office. This is a long con, and it doesn't always work. But I felt like that was just a very, very clear kind of linear progression of a good line into the slightly more mainstream parts of the party. And frankly, there are going to be people who could hear those sentiments from Ron DeSantis's mouth in a way that they were not going to hear them or appreciate them from either Nikki Haley or Chris Christie. So I guess, thanks, Ron.
Could also be a way of differentiating themselves as all former governors, right, or one current governor and former governor, from the swamp dwellers like Tim Scott.
Sure, the perennial competition to be the outsider.
Yes, and Mike Pence too is not an outsider, according to that Reason contributor. Mike Pence is not
Reason contributor. Outsider. Mike Pence, as we shall henceforth refer to him.
The so-called Reason contributor. Nick, who did you enjoy or find noteworthy to watch?
I also want to tell people to, you know, watch the Trump speech before that, which was counter-programming, and I was watching his address from an auto parts manufacturer in Michigan, which a bunch of right-wing channels and streaming services carried even as it cut into the GOP presidential debate, which is kind of fascinating. I mean, in terms of media, everybody knows that Trump, is going to get more eyeballs than a bunch of, eight dwarves or whatever were on stage this time. And that's kind of interesting in and of itself. But Vivek Ramaswamy, he kind of makes me laugh because he's the young guy and he's the young immigrant tech entrepreneur. And he, wants to increase the voting age. He wants to shut the border, even though he's the son of immigrants. And when he was asked about, whatever, he would pivot to the Swiss cheese border, about fentanyl and things like that. And he is an incredible talker. Zach Weismuller and I interviewed him for an hour and a half, for Reason a couple months ago. He won't give straight answers to anything other than how great America is and how great it should be again. When we asked him about cutting spending, he immediately talked about growing our way out of, having to do anything about entitlements or runaway spending. When you ask him about Ukraine, he'll talk about something else, et cetera. And so I found that particularly annoying, since he seems to be running for the Commerce Secretary slot in Trump's second administration.
I like how he was trying to put on a kinder, gentler face in this debate, since he was such a jerk last time around. And everyone obviously had the knives out, especially Nikki Haley. Whatever fight that is, I love it and I want all of it and more. But he has this sort of faux humility moment of like, hey, you know, some people think that I'm a bit of a know-it-all. I don't know everything. And then like 3 minutes later, it's like, let me tell you why every interpretation of the 14th Amendment for the last 150 years is incorrect. And I only have the truth, which is that it is allowing us to, you know, expel the children of legal immigrants. Or illegal immigrants who were born on American soil, et cetera. Just great. No notes. Perfect. Suderman, what did you notice of interest?
Well, we learned how long Mike Pence has been sleeping with a teacher. And
that
the
was
exact
good.
Price of Nikki Haley's diplomatic residence window dressing. That was really just incredibly. I learned so much.
They weren't hers. Obama paid for those.
That's right.
Come on. She was very clear about that.
Barack Hussein Obama, I think.
But since we are talking about GOP candidate Mad Libs, here's one for you from Ron DeSantis. I will use the Justice Department to bring civil rights cases against all of those left-wing Soros-funded prosecutors. That's good, right? Like you just won the crossword puzzle with that one.
There was, I know we're not supposed to tell tales out of Slack, but there were several different Slack channels that were operating somewhat in parallel internally during that debate. And on all of them, someone was like, wait, is that a thing? Like in this very like,
oh, it's definitely
Greek
a thing.
Chorus kind of way. I mean, it's a thing that people are saying. It's not really a thing that he can or should
this
do.
Is a shibboleth amongst the right now, and their argument is that if it weren't for George Soros funded left-wing prosecutors, everything would be great in terms of crime in American cities, and all of the disorder that people are mad about is just caused by George Soros and progressive prosecutors. And DeSantis has actually taken action against some prosecutors in Florida, including suspending Monique Worrell, the Orlando area state attorney. And then, of course, this went to the courts, and a judge ruled that DeSantis had violated the First Amendment in suspending Worrell. It is pretty ironic that DeSantis is doing all of this under the pretense of being the law and order guy. And in order to be the law and order guy, it involves violating the Constitution.
I think you're pointing to a paradox here, Peter Suderman, if I'm not mistaken. The thing I noticed, Nick kind of alluded to it, Trump wasn't there. I feel like we as a country are not, and definitely the Republican Party, but also the media, are not figuring out what to do with the Trump-sized hole in Republican politics, by which I mean, like, he wasn't really asked, it wasn't the topic of a question of a debate of his seven distant competitors. We only got at the very end, Dana Perino says, you know, you're all like way behind. So who are you going to vote off the island? Which was a pretty silly way to approach it. I say that as someone who likes Dana and appreciated her attempts to keep anything on tracks during this debate. But to me, that's the first question. And it's one that nobody really wants to answer too much besides Chris Christie, so that he can do his Donald Duck line.
You know, that gets better every time you hear
just
it.
Just going to polish that little rock. What's the biggest reason why Donald Trump shouldn't be president? You're competing against him. Clearly, you think he shouldn't be president. So what is your biggest reason for that? And part of the reason why you ask it is to watch people like Ron DeSantis squirm because he's trying to straddle, appealing to Trump voters and competing against him. But also, it's like a real legitimate question. And it's a great question, particularly for those of us who are not Republicans or who at least are very independent leaning Republican voters. You want to know what they think about a person who has had some consequence in American politics over the last 8 years, who has been, he's under criminal indictment in four separate cases, says a lot of crazy things every single week, all the time. And that's another kind of weird media sized hole. Like there was a lot of coverage of his speech in Detroit in front of non-unionized auto workers, but mostly as a like, oh, that's an interesting indicator of the shifting kind of political sands in the Republican Party. And that is indeed an interesting thing to talk about. But also, he did all kinds of crazy stuff last week, like basically say that General Mike Mills should be rung up for treason for all of his baselines. Just
like he says, poopy pants moment there.
It's every moment is a poopy pants moment for Matt. He says crazy stuff all the time, and people are just so fatigued from it. They're like, oh, well, if you dwell on that, then that's just because you have Trump derangement syndrome. So we're just not even going to write about it or talk about it too much. And this is particularly on the Republican side, too. Like, people don't want to address the elephant in the room, and he is an elephant, and this is a room. So it's just it's an interesting dynamic to watch, I think. Nick,
does the room with the elephant also have the adults in it? The adults.
Yeah, I was going to say, if Trump is the elephant in the room, I think you're in the wrong room, Matt Walsh.
There you go.
Yeah.
Reach for the stars.
You know, one of the clear takeaways from this GOP debate, and it's only going to get worse, you know, when they get rid of Burgum and a couple of the other people start disappearing from the edges, is none of them is even pretending to offer a vision of, you know, the future that isn't about, don't worry, you will get more of this, the pie that is shrinking in front of us, or the, you know, that is being baked into a cinder. And, you know, it's not like you can just snap your hands and, you know, come up with some kind of Reaganite vision of the future. But none of these people have that. Like, they really don't. They can't look at a future that is different than the present or distinct from the past and kind of sell it. And they can't attack Trump. Like, the one thing that they could say is Trump in two national elections failed to even crack 47% of the popular vote. He can't fucking win again. He got lucky. I mean, it's like the, you know, the win of the country's history, you know, that he beat Hillary Clinton and he beat her fair and square, you know, like according to the rules and stuff. But he can't win again. They can't attack that because their policies are not distinct from him, you know, and they're just like less interesting versions of him. And this, until the Republican Party really starts changing what it stands for, or going back to what it used to stand for, like, there, it's just going to dribble away in duller and duller and more cacophonous, useless debates.
They can't make the argument that he can't win again because Republican voters don't buy it. Kristen Soltis Anderson, the pollster, who is a friend of Reason, has been making this point that when you survey Republican voters, they do not believe that Trump cannot win again, and you can't convince them.
But
and
there are fewer.
And there was a poll that just came out within the last week showing showing Trump up 10 points on Joe Biden. Now, there's arguments that that poll was an outlier, that it was bad, that there were problems with the numbers. It's 13 months out. Polls don't tell us really don't tell us very much at all about the final state of the election that's going to happen over a year from now. At the same time, the polling is very, very close, even when you discount that poll. And there are now polls showing that he's winning not just by a little, but bigly.
He has run for president twice, and he has failed to get even 47% of the popular vote. Republican voters, to the extent that they insist that Trump can win, will lose the popular vote for, you know, like the 20th time in a row, basically. I mean,
let's get to our listener email of the week, trying to get through a lot of topics unusually on this podcast. This is a reminder to all of you to please email your short queries to us here at roundtable@reason.com. We read every single one. Just know that. This one comes from Dave Hood, the great Dave Hood, who writes, an executive order to establish an American Climate Corps? What's your take on that? A fart in the wind? Just more pork? A foot in the door? I love the metaphors here, Dave. Bypassing Congress that will turn into yet another powerful, unaccountable interest group? Or stroke of the pen regulating agency? That is the question. Little extra context. The president of the United States 10 days ago announced an executive order establishing a new American Climate Corps to, quote, this is exciting, mobilize a new diverse generation of more than 20,000 Americans, putting them to work conserving and restoring our lands and waters, bolstering community resilience, deploying clean energy, implementing energy-efficient technologies, and advancing environmental justice, all while creating pathways to high-quality, good-paying, clean energy and climate resilience jobs in the public and private sectors after they complete their paid training program, end quote. Begin barf. Catherine, what is your answer to this question?
I wish I loved anything in this life as much as politicians love trying to, like, create backdoor national service programs. Like, they just love the idea of an army of youth, maybe in matching outfits, doing their bidding. And that's not great. That's not a healthy impulse. We shouldn't do that. It's bipartisan. It's, you know, Vivek Ramaswamy wants it. Pete Buttigieg wants it. Like, younger politicians who should know better want it. Old politicians who should know better want it. I went and read the, like, 17,000 bullet point list of things that this program is supposed to do, which of course is like a job training program and also will somehow stop climate change or whatever. It's probably not going to do either of those things. But way, way down, there was a notice of proposed rulemaking that would create a pathway for people who participate in this program to go straight to working for the federal government. And that, I think, is the real major implication of this. It's just another way to suck in people to become crappy federal employees. And I wish we would stop doing this. Like, this will not solve any of the problems it is ostensibly going to solve, and will instead just create another big dumb program.
Nick, that can't possibly be improved on, but try.
Yeah, now it made me think of VISTA, Volunteers in Service to America, which was founded by John F. Kennedy, who it was like a domestic version of the Peace Corps, because why should people in developing countries be the only one to suffer? It's still around. There's like 5,000 people in it, and you never hear about it because it doesn't matter. That's what I thought of when I heard about this.
I walk by a bus stop ad for the Peace Corps every day on my commute. And it's like two kind of middle-aged people looking into the distance. And like the photo's not very good. And it's just so perfectly captures the Peace Corps. Like, it's the advertising is too good.
I mean, without the Peace Corps, how are our recent college graduates going to learn how to play Ultimate Frisbee?
And the guitar.
Oh, my heart bleeds. Peter, what say you?
Do you think they play the guitar, or is it more like, it feels like a drum circle vibe to me?
Like the Peace Corps is everywhere. Situation? The Peace Corps is in so many places. There are so many. Maybe it's a zither scenario.
Depends on where you are. That horrible drum circle over close to where you people live?
Mm-hmm. In Malcolm X Park.
Yes. Malcolm X Park. That is the world's biggest Peace Corps contingent in the United States of drum circle participants. Peter, continue.
This sounds like an expensive make work program for a bunch of goody two shoes progressive youths, and it's a bad idea.
Ooh, shots fired from the normally calm Peter Suderman. Okay, we're going to get to yet another topic, and this is more lightning round time as we were getting up against it last week after a long enfeeblement and much longer career in politics. California Senator Dianne Feinstein died at the age of 90. Governor Gavin Newsom declined to pick Meghan Markle as her replacement, electing instead to select a Black lesbian abortion activist from Maryland named LaFonza Butler. I would not usually include all of those descriptors, but he had promised that that basic demographic would be box checked. Let's quickly go around the table and each pick one thing about the dearly departed DiFi. Nick, why don't you lead us off?
As a city council, the equivalent of the city council in San Francisco before she became mayor, after the assassination of Willie Moscone, the mayor was killed by Dan White, who also killed Harvey Milk. She palled around a lot with Jim Jones of the People's Temple, and she tried to shut down porn theaters. You know, she was a bad mayor who is the hero, actually, though, of Season of the Witch, David Talbot's great book about San Francisco. And she was a generally a bad senator whose big claim to fame was pushing an assault weapon ban, which studies by the federal government found had no statistical effect on crime.
Catherine, what say you?
I appreciate that she, you know, the writers for this season or the crafters of our simulation or whatever you want to say, have used her to excellent effect to put a fine point on the rising concerns about the gerontocracy. There have been many such notes sounded in this political season, but having her you know, be the center of a fairly long controversy about her competence, only to die in office, clearly having long been unable to perform her job, really at age 90, really does highlight how this is an incredibly serious problem. I, you know, reading the coverage of how her replacement was selected, you know, among other things, there was this difficult problem of, like, she had already announced that she was not going to run again. And so contenders for her seat are in place. And, you know, Newsom was in the sticky position of having to decide whether or not to pick one of them to hold the seat on an interim basis. The fact that he just did it as a gimme to a fundraiser, really, again, just putting a really fine point on our politics. Like, this lady got this gig because she checked demographic boxes and because, like, she brings the rain, because she is she brings money to a lot of the players in this space. And like, a Senate seat shouldn't be a little plum. It shouldn't be like a little present you get for raising a lot of money for the party. It's a really important job. Like, we should be taking more seriously who is occupying that seat. Although the backup option, or the sort of most likely backup option, Barbara Lee, she's, I think, 77. Is that right? So that's maybe a short-lived solution as well.
Peter, DiFi?
Yeah, speaking of goody-two-shoes progressive youths, Dianne Feinstein was mean to a bunch of kids. And it was great. Specifically, she was mean to a bunch of children that were sent to her office back in 2019 to demand that she pass the Green New Deal. And she was just like, no, you're ridiculous. You are children. You have no idea what you are talking about. There's a video of this where you can see her just dismissing this band of, like, really sort of cute looking, kind of earnest climate change activist children. And she's just like, there's reasons why I can't. For example, there's no way to pay for it. And also, I don't agree with what the resolution says. And then she explains to them that also this isn't how politics works. And even if I were willing to vote for this dumb thing, other people wouldn't. And that's a bad way of trying to do legislation. And she just, like, gives them a little lesson on, like, why they're kids and they're dumb and they don't understand how politics works and their ideas about global warming and the Green New Deal and completely rewriting the economy are just kind of stupid. And so I have a lot of disagreements, obviously, with her as a policymaker, but I like that she was mean to children about bad laws.
Wait, but you left out the best pit. You left out the zinger, where they say, we voted for you. And she says, how old are you? And they say 16. And she says, then you didn't. Like, incredible.
As a California native, she was my senator for 1,000 years, I guess. There's this thing that happens in one party states, which California became in the 90s. Or one-party Democratic states. I presume that there's an analog of this on the Republican side, but I can't immediately call it to mind because I tend to live in these places. The lifer politicians in one-party states tend to not be, as in Democratic state, as progressive as the George Soros-funded prosecutors might have you believe. Dianne Feinstein was incredibly conservative. She's incredibly authoritarian. I commend everyone to read Jacob Sullum talking about her over the weekend, giving her policies righteous criticizing. And it was this eternal consternation among California residents, like, why can't we do anything about her? She seems to be bad on almost everything, although she did go against the CIA's torture program in 2014. It's worth mentioning. I think.
Well, and after she found out that the government or the deep state was spying on her.
Yeah, you know, she got mad about it. It's probably had more to do
with
that.
She got angry about it, yeah.
But that happens. That happens in a lot of ways. There's, you know, Chuck Schumer isn't, even though he's progressive in many senses, but he's also a huge disappointment to the AOCs of the world. And it kind of always is thus. Once you have a one party state, you get people who find a way to get elected once, and they just sit on it forever. And in her case, obviously, long past the time that she was mentally, physically competent to be a senator. And it should hopefully cause people to reflect on how one party governance just isn't great. It usually doesn't work out so great. It doesn't produce great politicians. It doesn't produce great policies either. I don't know exactly how to fix that, but being aware of it is the first step. All right, let's get to our last step on this podcast, which is the what we have all been consuming in the cultural arena. Nick, why don't you lead us off?
I watched the movie that's in theaters now called Bottoms. It's directed by Emma Seligman, who also co-wrote it with Rachel Sinnott, who's also, I think, in the movie. But this is the best parody of a high school movie that has been around in, I would say, years. It could even be decades.
Wow.
It's about two lesbian girls or queer girls who are losers in their high school, and they create a female fight club basically to have contact with other women. This takes place in a Strangers with Candy type universe. Marshawn Lynch is the faculty advisor to the club, who is totally hilarious, and people who know him from his unwillingness to give press conferences as a football player will deeply enjoy his portrayal. Everybody in this universe is kind of an idiot, but it also ultimately is a kind of kind-hearted Napoleon Dynamite type universe. If Napoleon Dynamite was dipped, that world was dipped into a vat of LSD. Highly, highly recommend it. Bottoms is a fantastic movie by a really young filmmaker who's got one who's unfortunately is Canadian, but doing her best work in the United States. It's just a tremendous movie, and I thank my older son for recommending it to me.
Honorary Americans when they do good. Peter, what did you consume?
I watched the 4K re-release of Stop Making Sense, the 1983 Talking Heads concert film directed by Jonathan Demme. So I've heard the live album hundreds, maybe thousands of times before, but I'd never actually seen the movie despite having heard great things about it for years. And folks, it is a revelation. It captures the band at its peak. There is a sense of energy and intimacy that you almost never get from movie versions of concerts, thanks in part to the cinematography by the great Jordan Cronenweth, who had just come off of shooting Blade Runner, which is one of my favorite movies of all times. And because of the way that this movie is shot on 35mm close-up, incredibly well-lit, you get this sense of the band as a musical organism, a bunch of independent cells that kind of come together to function as a single cohesive whole on stage. If you've ever played music with a group, you've probably had that experience where you almost cease to be your own totally independent self, and you are thinking and acting and speaking and playing as a kind of a group mind, as a hive mind. And it's a really hard thing to capture and show to other people on film, but this movie does it. It is just an extraordinary, joyful document of a great musical act at its peak. It's playing around the country in limited release this week. If you like Talking Heads, if you like great music, if you like beauty and joy and wonderful things, you should make an effort to see it.
I would also recommend, based on the memories of 18-year-old Matt Welch, if you don't like the Talking Heads, or at least are indifferent about them because they're from the East Coast and screw those people, it is also a revelatory, even maybe more of a revelatory movie. I remember seeing that freshman year of college in a nice big theater. And
the movie
holy
was recorded
cow.
On the West Coast.
Yes, Pantages, I think, in Hollywood. It is an amazing thing to watch. And also, cocaine is a hell of a drug. I have never tried it, but man, does it work. It just works. Catherine, what did you consume besides cocaine?
I am nothing if not a cliche. And so I have come slightly late to a podcast that launched earlier this year from the Freakonomics radio network, The Economics of Everyday Things. This is my sweet spot, y'all.
Oh,
it's
boy.
A little podcast. It's short. It's 22 minutes or 15 minutes or something. And it takes an object and it explains the whole world based on that object. It's good. This week's episode was about pizza boxes. Did you ever wonder things about pizza boxes? You can listen to this episode and Zachary Crockett will explain all about them to you. If you're interested in pizza, you might also stay tuned for a Reason magazine feature by Peter Suderman about pizza in the next issue. I don't want to spoil it, but it will be controversial. Other good episodes include Girl Scout cookies and also what goes into vending machines. I don't care that I'm a cliche. You listen to this podcast and you're probably maybe like me in that you like podcasts like this. If you do, check out The Economics of Everyday Things. It's kind of a blockbuster in its category, so you've probably already heard of it. But
tell me one pizza fact. Pizza box fact.
A good fact is that you actually can recycle greasy pizza boxes despite the myth that they are not recyclable, up to 7 times.
What does that mean? That you can recycle it up 7 times?
You can put
times.
Another pizza in it 7 times?
No, that cardboard can be recycled 7 times. Like,
are there people who say you can't? Because I've been putting my cardboard pizza boxes in the recycling box.
Absolutely a thing that people tell each other is you can't recycle pizza boxes because they're greasy.
Nick, I don't know about you, but when I hear controversial pizza feature, I just presume that Suderman's going to be objectively pro, what is it, Noids?
Oh, yeah. He doesn't try to avoid the Noid. He embraces the Noid, Matt Welch.
Sorry for snarkling on the microphone.
Yeah,
I have no idea what you're talking about, which is normal.
The Domino's pizza anti-spokesman. The Noid was a claymation figure who would attack your pizza on the delivery route home, so it was ruined by the time you ate it. And most famously, in 1992, made an appearance at a George H.W. Bush campaign event where the former or future one-term president was shaking hands with the Domino's pizza Noid.
Did I do drugs?
Yep.
In the womb. In the womb. Flashbacks all the way down.
This is
sadly
yet
my
enough.
Piece does not mention the Noid. But he would
try to jackhammer his way into the Domino's pizza box, which was, you know, a quantum leap better than the shitty floppy pizza boxes, with a little jackhammer. Matt.
Did you go out as the Noid for Halloween
several years in a row?
I continue to marvel, unironically, at all of the incredible amounts of absolute cultural detritus that live in Nick Gillespie's brain and available for a total recall at all times. It's a marvelous thing. It should be studied by science. In this house, we believe in the science of understanding Nick Gillespie's brain because it is impossible.
You brought up the Noid, not me.
I know, but you had the 1992 campaign appearance. Yeah. It's just sitting there. I was like unconfident that Noid was correct and that it was my own drug.
Maybe
flashback.
That was the difference maker. Forget H. Ross Perot. It was the appearance with the Noid. You know, he lost the coast, the pizza eaters on the coast with it.
Speaking of coastal elites, that doesn't really work. Teased on a recent kind of what you scenario here on this podcast, I actually did, for the first time in nearly half a century, attend a Renaissance fair with my my 8-year-old daughter, who is all in. She's been all about the Lord of the Rings and whatnot. If you haven't ever been to Renaissance Fair, but also if you haven't been since you were a kid and you were a kid a long time ago, it is so strange. It's so weird. It's great. The amount of it's a bunch of subcultures that are sort of mashed together into one subculture, and it doesn't make technical sense at all. Like if you just sort of base on the adults wearing costume situation, you have a lot of people obviously dressed like Stevie Nicks kind of gypsy era. You have a lot of Robin Hoods and the sort of barmaid wenches types, and then you also have a lot of Slash from Guns N' Roses, like the with a top hat and like the skulls and everything. And it's hard to say exactly what part of medieval or Renaissance era Europe looks like the lead guitarist for Guns N' Roses, but it works, people. The jousting, the Slash, the sword swallowing, because that was well known for medieval France. A lot of sword swallowing went down there to the falconry, and everyone's just addressing you, my lords, my liege. The guy is like showing you his buzzard. So, my lords, like, why do you have to do the my lords thing? You're just showing me a goddamn bird. It's just great. My daughter loved it.
Did you have mead, Matt Welch?
I did not because I was driving. Speaking of which, so I would the Renaissance Fair in New York in Orange County and adjacent to Tuxedo Park, Nick Gillespie, 40 miles from where I'm sitting here right now. It was the parking situation there apparently was designed by the same artist who brought us the Washington, D.C. Union Station taxi drop off and also the LAX horseshoe by open masochists who want to crush everyone's dreams in a car. If whatever time they tell you to get there on your little Google robot or whatever, add double it because the last mile, it will take you an hour and a half. It is so wretchedly horrible. But they have a permanent kind of a settlement there in, you know, sort of nice in the woods and everything. It's really great and lovely, and it will end next weekend, and it's nice out here. So if you're in the tri-state area, Nick, I recommend going early, mead and 3 hours in a car don't really work out too well.
Do you have a turkey leg?
The line was too long. I wanted to. It looked great. Instead,
so did you get a hot dog instead?
I got.
I don't know why we're so focused on what Matt consumed.
Because I'm in funnel cake. I got a medieval funnel cake.
I got a medieval fully loaded quesadilla. None of it makes sense is what I'm saying, and it's fantastic. No,
but it's delightful.
It's delightful, yep. And just so many bodices, Catherine. I don't know what's going on. How many bodices there have to be in this world? But there's
never
just
enough, Matt.
People want any of them to wear ripped bodices. I you know, my eyes are up. I'm like having you know.
Matt's very respectful.
I'm a respectful person. Anyways, Renaissance Fair, crazy, just Americana at its greatest, like a mashup of carny culture and whatever. The swords and sandals,
Game of Thrones.
Who knows? I'm not sure anyone else does. But
a little steampunk.
Beautiful.
My family
tolerance.
Went last year, and my son went dressed as a dragon from Minecraft, and was universally hailed to be clearly on point and on brand for the Renaissance Fair culture. Great. So just
that's
if you want to try meat at home, you can always make your own.
Yeah.
It's just a fermented honey water with a bunch of fruit.
You're a fermented honey water with a bunch of fruit. I don't know what that means.
Thank you.
That was like the distilled essence of a bat.
Yeah.
Please stop.
Okay.
Pence-worthy.
Time to end the podcast. I just want to say about that Pence thing, the sleeping with a teacher thing. A lot of people decided to get mad at Chris Christie for saying Joe Biden's been sleeping with a teachers union member for 38 years, or actually his was longer, 1,000 years. But Biden says that all the time.
Yeah, Biden says that all the time. You can't be mad. Like, you can be mad at Chris Christie for a lot of things, including that Donald Duck joke, but like, you can't be mad for that line.
You can be mad at Mike Pence 10 minutes later. Apropos of nothing, looking off in the distance and reminding us that he sleeps with women. That's just not right. It's wrong.
With woman. Woman.
Thank you.
One.
Mother.
Yeah. Okay. We're going to stop this. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you next week. We have a lot of podcasts, or at least a couple. Go to reason.com/podcasts for it. We have a lot of events, including New York City, including with Nick Gillespie, prominently featured. Nick, this is your time to say something about those things.
We've got 3 events in October coming up. Go to reason.com/events to check them out. There is something for everyone. One of them may be a Renaissance Fair. Don't hold me to that, but maybe. You know, or certainly you can come dressed in whatever era you want.
Bodice is always appropriate attire for a Nick Gillespie event.
More like a Renaissance unfair?
No.
Yeah, that is, I think...
We're done.
Wow. Yeah.
Goodbye.
I know what it's like to be dead.